Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the weekdays. And so we've almost had enough of them for the week. That's good. Trying my patience. Hey, guess what, man? Jim Bovard is going to be on the show. You know, I really should have stopped to think of some jokes to say and some funny things to say, so I could try to get Jim to laugh. It's really too bad if I do an interview with Bovard and I don't make him laugh, you know? That's happened. And then the poor guy feels obligated to laugh because he knows what a great laugh he's got, how much I like hearing it. Well, anyway, I hope I come up with something so you guys can hear Bovard laugh. I can hear it now. All right, Bovard coming up on the show. And then, hey, also, guess what? Who's also a libertarian? Sheldon Richman. Oh, he's about as libertarian as hell. Yeah. And he wrote a thing. Let me talk with him about that. So that should be a good time. Couple of good libertarians on the show today. And then, you know what? I hope to hear back from Con Hallinan. I should have called him. You know what? I'm going to call him at the break, dude. Call Con Hallinan. Because, you know why? He wrote this thing about Saudi, and it's interesting. That's why. I want to hear him talk about it out loud is because of the thing. There. All right. And then, I don't know about Mitch Prother. I guess he's out running around with the Kurds on the battlefield. Hopefully not getting shot at. Got to get him back on the show here soon. But that's a problem. Okay. Local problem. Okay, man, I need to write up a tweet for the show since my site is still broken and I can't write blog entries on it. Today's show, Jim Bovard and Sheldon Richman from 12 to 2 Eastern at lrn.fm. There we go. Gotta put that on liberty.me. Also, oh, gotta log in first. Are you on liberty.me? You could be. There's good stuff on there, man. It's pretty cool. Should check it out. Like, for example, every morning you get my who's on the show status. That's worth the sign up right there. Man. All right. Sorry I didn't get a chance to mention this when it happened the other day because I was in the middle of interviewing other people about other things when the story broke. Islamic State claims Beirut bombings, 43 killed, over 200 wounded. Suicide bombers detonated in Palestinian refugee camp. A pair of suicide bombers tore through the Palestinian refugee camp. God dang it, Bobby. A pair of suicide bombers tore through the Palestinian refugee camp of Burj al-Barajne. I don't know, man. In the southern part of the Lebanese capital city of Beirut, killing at least 43 people and wounding over 200 others, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. ISIS issued a statement almost immediately thereafter, claiming credit for the bombing and saying it targeted Hezbollah, which uses the targeted neighborhood as a stronghold. Several Syrian Islamist factions have targeted Hezbollah, whatever, in recent years because of Hezbollah's support for the Syrian government. Hezbollah insists such attacks won't change their policy. The Interior Ministry reported there was a third would-be suicide bomber in the group, but that he was positioned too close to one of the others and killed him before he could detonate his own bomb. His body was found with the suicide vest still on him. Lebanon's local Al-Qaeda faction, the Abdullah Azzam Brigades, also claimed credit for the bombing, threatening more unless Hezbollah withdraws all forces, all support for the Assad government in Syria, though most officials seem to believe it was the Islamic State and not Al-Qaeda who actually launched the strike. Either way, remember, all, especially you conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, all your talking points here are that in a fight between Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, which is still the same damn thing, both of them are just break-offs, al-Nusra and ISIS are both just break-offs of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In a fight between them and Hezbollah, you're supposed to be on the side of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And the answer is because, right, I'm skipping why, huh? The answer is because that's what Israel wants. Israel hates Hezbollah more. And so America's policy is just like Al-Qaeda's policy. I mean, not suicide bombing Palestinian refugee camps in southern Lebanon, but supporting those who do. Because that's what Israel wants. And, in fact, here, I like playing this. I think you probably like hearing it. You need to hear it. This is Benjamin Netanyahu's ambassador to the United States, former ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, explaining to Jeffrey Goldberg at the Aspen Fancy Pants Institute, where we're all in on it and can talk frankly about these things.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
Yeah, there you go. The Sunni evil being, and he admits he's not talking about the mythical moderates. He's referring directly to the Islamic State and the video of them massacring 1,700 prisoners laid out in a parking lot, machine gunned to death. But hey, they're up against the government of Syria, which is backed by Iran, which has military nuclear technology. Yeah, in a lot of lies it does. Not in reality. And because Assad is responsible for all the deaths in the war, that is basically a foreign invasion of his country. By America, Turkey, Saudi, Qatar, and Israel. Supporting these terrorists. Not just a Sunni insurgency, but really, a Sunni insurgency led by guys who are still sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. Jabhat al-Nusra, led by, what's his name, the killer, Golani, who will cut your head off if you're a Druze and you refuse to convert. Who's no different than Zarqawi, who takes his orders from Zawahiri. Anyway, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page of who's on whose side here, America's government is on the side of the American people's enemies, Al-Qaeda. That's pretty simple. General Allen says we may be condemned to fight ISIS forever. Yeah, especially if we keep backing them and their friends and keep working with our allies to make sure that they can't lose even as we fight them. May be condemned to fight ISIS forever, says General Allen. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the show. Hey, man, so I was supposed to talk about Yemen on the Ernie show this morning, but instead we talked about other stuff. And but I want to talk about this a little bit just because nobody's really telling the story. And if you talk about it at all out of context, and nobody knows the context, and I don't know, man, I'm just trying to be useful to you here to understand that America's at war with Yemen right now. And, you know, you'll have to go to news.antiwar.com to catch up completely on all the details of, you know, who's killing who on a regular basis, on a daily basis, on a timely basis. And I've told this before, but, you know, I'm hoping it'll help you. The background is there are some Al-Qaeda guys in Yemen. Again, back before 9/11, all through the 90s, their problem was the Americans occupying the land of the two holy places, national borders on the peninsula, notwithstanding. One of the San Diego cell hijackers, the Flight 77 hijackers, his father-in-law ran what was called the Switchboard House there. And where they basically fielded the phone calls between Afghanistan and various Al-Qaeda minions in the West and the hijackers, etc. And interesting part of the story, read James Bamford, you want to know about all that. But anyway, so there's a tiny little AQAP cell there. Remember, there was one of the friends of the Lackawanna Six was killed. An American citizen was killed in a drone strike by George W. Bush in 2002 in Yemen. And they said, well, we weren't targeting him, and it's his fault for palling around with terrorists. Tough. That was about it. But then by the time Obama came into office, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula had been growing a little bit. So what did he start doing? He started bombing them with drones in 2009, his first year in office. And in doing so, he multiplied their numbers a million times, just like the entire damn terror war in a microcosm, although not that micro. And the more he bombed them, the more he made of them. He started bombing them and bombing them before they sent the underpants bomber, Christmas 2009. He'd been bombing them for 6 weeks before that, including had massacred 30-something women and children with cluster bombs, which has got to be one of the worst ways to die. I mean, I don't know. I guess if you're dying in a war, it's going to be pretty damn bad no matter what, right? But yeah. Women and children torn apart with cluster bombs. All this is documented. Hell, Obama had Yemen lock up the journalist who was reporting the truth of it. Personally intervened to make sure the guy was locked up. And anyway, all they did was bribe the dictatorship of Saleh. That was the dictator. And they owned him for 20 or 30 years anyway before that. But they paid him more and more and armed him more and more to fight Al-Qaeda for us. But of course he didn't. He fought the Houthi movement, which was a movement of Shia separatists up in the north. And he kept picking fights with them and losing. And they kept getting more and more powerful every time he would pick a fight with them and lose. And just the same as Al-Qaeda was getting more and more powerful every time they were getting bombed by the United States, by the CIA and Air Force drones. So then comes the Arab Spring, mostly as a result of Iraq War II. And when the Arab Spring comes, virtually every faction in Yemen turns on Saleh and says, get the hell out. Massive pressure. And then Hillary Clinton pulled a judo on him and eased out the dictator and replaced him with his chief of staff or vice president, I guess, Hadi. Okay? Saleh, old dictator. Hadi, new dictator. Fake democratic election with one man's name on the ballot. And all this. Well, then the Houthis, they came down from the north, and geez, I guess I'm skipping a step in here. Hadi, you know, started picking his own fight with the Houthis, and then they won it. And they came down out of the north. The even the president of the United States himself, not just his minions, but Obama himself admits, and he was admitting this. He wasn't like, oh, he was spinning for Iran. He was conceding that, yes, it's true, Iran told the Houthis, who are Shia like them, and they have a somewhat friendly relationship, not to march on the capital city of Sana'a. And they did it anyway. And then this became the so-called excuse and drove Hadi out of power. And then this became the so-called excuse for Saudi Arabia and the United States of America to launch this terrible air war. And that was 8 months ago. They've been under a full-scale blockade and an air bombing campaign. Amazingly, I don't know, man, almost unbelievably to me, reports are that 5,000 have been killed, when I would guess that it's maybe 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times that or something. It's got to be. And obviously reporting out of there is terrible, but there's been a lot of violence for 8 months straight there. And 5,000, that's a lot of individual human beings to be killed. America lost 4,500 troops in the entire Iraq War, too. That's how many, not how few, how many 5,000 is. But it's got to be more than that. And then plus hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people are, and of course, especially the weakest, the youngest, the children, are suffering malnutrition and hunger and even, apparently, depending on which NGOs you ask, starvation. And there are ground troops there, but it's a stalemate. There's nothing like a, you know, miraculous, victorious Saudi march to Sana'a going on here. You know, even back in the Libya war in 2011, when it wasn't going very well, it took them 9 months. Still, you heard me say on this show every time we covered it that whole year long that, I mean, eventually they're going to get it done. It's a simple march from east to west, and it's going slower. It's a slog. It was supposed to be easy, but it'll still be done by the end of the year. Come on. And, of course, it was. In this case, that's not so clear. The Houthis seem to be holding their own, and they fight based out of a mountainous region, and it's been a stalemate this whole time. And innocent people are dying, and no good is coming of it. Patrick Coburn and many other great journalists have all pointed to the new king and his son or nephew or whatever it is, who's the new minister of defense, who's a young kid, 23 years old or some crap like that, and is trying to prove what a tough guy he is with this big stupid war, and using America, you know, number one, the world's only superpower, as his tiny little plaything. Barack Obama, and therefore you and me, as his humble servants, to wage this war against the civilian population of Yemen. Oh, and by the way, in ways that severely benefit al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and has now led to at least some groups claiming allegiance to the Islamic State there and committing atrocities. But it was reported even in major newspapers, man, maybe British ones, but still, about al-Qaeda seizing airports and weapons magazines and seaports and real territorial gains of wealth and power and weapons, with America flying as their air force, coordinating the whole damn war for the Saudis, refueling all the bombers, etc. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. On the line is Jim Bovard. He wrote a bunch of books about how stupid and horrible the government is. And no, seriously, you should go look at even, it's on his website, but it's also, I think, on his Wikipedia page, where they got all the quotes of the leaders of the various government bureaucracies denouncing Jim and all of his works. He is the scourge of the executive branch, author of The Fair Trade Fraud and The Farm Fiasco, Feeling Your Pain and Freedom in Chains, and Terrorism and Tyranny, The Bush Betrayal, Attention Deficit Democracy, and his latest is the memoir Public Policy Hooligan, which you can get on Amazon, on your Kindle, or in, I guess, paperback and all that, too. Public Policy Hooligan. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Jim?
Hey, doing good. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Now, listen, man, I got a screw-up and a double-booking type thing here, so I hope it wouldn't hurt your feelings too much if we keep this interview to one segment, and then I'll interview the other guy in the next segment.
That's fine, Scott. Let's roll.
Because neither of you were available to be bumped to the end of the show. Cool. So, yeah, let's do this here. Local police officers should not be able to claim federal immunity from prosecution, and you may or may not have noticed that whenever I tweet out police abuse stories, always use the hashtag sovereign immunity. And I learned that phrase from following the news after the execution of white separatist Randy Weaver's wife, Vicky, back in 1992, after the marshals had murdered his young son, Sammy, a couple of days before that. But I remember when it was in the news that the federal court had basically taken the case out of state court and said, this is a civil rights case. Now we will decide, not you. And then they dropped the charges because they said that the FBI sniper from the hostage rescue team, Lon Horiuchi, had sovereign immunity from prosecution for the action he took when he blew that innocent unarmed woman's head off her shoulders. And so I never forgot that. Oh, and I learned quickly after that that this is what the kings of England used to claim. I have sovereign immunity because I'm the king of England. Except in England, hundreds of years ago, a couple hundred at least, few, they cut off the head of their king, Charles I, and said, no, you don't have sovereign immunity. You're just a man just like the rest of us, or we all have the same divine right as you. And anyway, so that's the thing, is here we are in America at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st, and the cops have a license to kill, a real live license to murder us if they feel like it, Jim.
Okay, are you done?
Yeah.
All right. It's fascinating how this has evolved, because back at the time of the revolution, the founding fathers, there was nobody who was championing the idea of sovereign immunity. But that was something which evolved from court cases and some of the Supreme Court kowtowing to the government, to the principle of government supremacy. And it's become a Pandora's box, which is violating more of our rights all the time. This is something which I discussed. I had a piece in USA Today on Monday entitled End Federal Agents' License to Kill, in which I talked about some of these ideas, and talked about that case there in Austin where you live, the Larry Jackson case this is someone who was killed by a policeman, and my understanding was that the local prosecutor wanted to prosecute the policeman to kill the guy without good reason, and all of a sudden you've got federal immunity because the local cop was on a federal task force. And as the Washington Post warned, this is something which could give unlimited protection to thousands of state and local police officers who are on federal task force.
Yeah. Well, huge lesson there for us non-government employees, for the white separatists and the Black Lives Matter movement and everybody else. If they can kill them, they can kill you, too. That's the deal. Rights are for everybody, or they're for nobody.
Well, and part of the problem with many of these shooting cases is what the government does is throw a cloak over the entire situation. And so it's not like there's going to be an independent investigation which finds the facts and then says, well, based on the facts, maybe it was justified. You have government agencies which, as soon as the shooting goes down, often basically block any kind of outside fact-finding. And so we're supposed to take the government's word on the government's killings. And that's very imprudent.
Yeah, well, okay, so now In this case, it's actually interesting. The federal thing actually is a statute, but in the rest of it, it all seems to be basically de facto sovereign immunity, not exactly like the Horiuchi case, but just kind of, as you're saying, the opacity of all the procedure around it, all the benefits that cops get when it comes to investigations of their crimes compared to regular people serve as kind of a de facto, in a de facto way as a license to kill, where it just never gets to court. It just never does.
Right. And, for instance, going back to the Ruby Ridge case, a key factor there with Deval Patrick was the guy, I think, who did the investigation. He's now, or he was, governor of Massachusetts. Not sure if he still is. He was the person who did the investigation and decided that the feds would not prosecute Horiuchi because Horiuchi had no intent to violate the civil rights of Vicki Weaver, who he blew the head off of. And, Lon Horiuchi was using a 10-power scope from 200 yards. A 10-power scope is possible to see a person's wedding ring from that distance. So it's a very, very powerful scope and a very powerful rifle. And he was a very accurate shot. But what happened was that the Justice Department did this so-called investigation, but at the same time, it basically ignored a lot of the key facts in the case, which happens very often when there's a police shooting or a shooting by a federal agent. I mean, something which riled me up was a case a year or two back, a while after the Boston bombing, there was a Chechen friend or acquaintance of one of the suspects in that bombing, and the FBI went down to question him in Florida, and something happened at the end of the questioning, and the FBI guy killed the FBI agent shot and killed the guy. And the government's changed its story a couple times on that shooting, but it's like if something like that had happened to a dissident in the Soviet Union back in the 1980s, nobody in the U.S. would have taken the government's word that, well, okay, it was necessary for the government agent to, for the KGB agent to shoot and kill the dissident at the end of the questioning. Mm-hmm. But that happened here, and most Americans seem pretty docile on that, and there's been far too little press investigation, and the FBI has been able to bottle up the facts, as happens so often.
Yeah, well, and now, what about these task forces? Because I guess we hear about them from time to time, a drug task force, a multi-jurisdictional task force. But you're saying this outright immunity under federal law can be applied to now thousands more, maybe tens of thousands more local cops around the country?
Right. This is based on a federal judge's ruling on the shooting there in Austin, Texas. And it's not my words. This is from the Washington Post, which says that the Austin case could extend federal immunity to thousands of state and local police officers who sign up for these federal task force. But the federal task force, very often driven by drugs, and, the war on drugs, you have an awful lot of government abuses, and this is the type of ruling which makes government far more perilous to people, because not only does it mean that the government agents are immune from prosecution, but it also makes it far less likely that we'll ever find out the truth about what happens when a government agent kills somebody.
Right. Well, and thank goodness for social media now. The TV can no longer black out these stories. Every local police murder story is now a national news story, and there is not a damn thing they can do to stop it. And I hope that means that eventually there is something that Americans can do to stop what's happening to us at their hands. It's so far out of control now. This article, everybody, is by Jim Bovard. It's in USA Today, and thank goodness for that, too. End federal agents licensed to kill. And federal agents licensed to kill, Jim Bovard, author of Public Policy Hooligan in USA Today. Thanks very much, Jim. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Scott.
And sorry for that massive rant at the beginning, but I'm so sick of this stuff. Right back in a sec, y'all. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, sorry, man, I had to cut Jim short. I like talking with Jim, but we'll have him back soon. But now it's time for David S. D'Amato from the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org. He is an attorney in international law and business and a libertarian writer. This one appeared at bleedingheartlibertarians.com. Should libertarians support the TPP? Welcome to the show. How are you doing, David?
I'm great, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, good deal. Very happy to have you here. And listen, I'm lazy and stupid, man. I never read the leaked text. And I know WikiLeaks has leaked portions here, there, and the other thing. And I think I read last week or earlier this week that all of it, they finally posted the whole thing online. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Now it's pretty much looking like it's going to be a done deal. The countries have acceded to it, and now it just needs to go through each party's sort of domestic process for however they approve international agreements.
Mm-hmm. And is there much of a debate going on in D.C., or it's pretty much a done deal there as far as Congress goes?
You know what? From where I sit, it looks like the interests have sort of prevailed again, and this one's going to be law.
Yeah. Predictable enough there. All right. So,
yep.
But now take us back and forgive me for not knowing too much about it. I did think it was funny. I'll give a little bit of credit to Rand Paul for calling out Donald Trump and all his bluster in the debate the other night when he said, "What are you talking about, man? China isn't even part of the TPP." And I thought that was funny that Trump was going, "China, man, they really screwed us on that deal." And he obviously doesn't know anything about it whatsoever, just like he says the same thing about the Iran deal, that he couldn't tell you a single detail in it. But anyway,
right.
so tell us the details. What is it? And you know what? Let's assume for the sake of argument that at least half the audience thinks that it's must be a pretty good thing, or else why would they do it?
Right. So I'll just give the 30,000-foot view for, you know, anyone listening who's not an attorney and not an expert in international law or intellectual property law. So it's a treaty. It's an international agreement that has a variety of provisions on all sorts of things that have nothing to do with intellectual property. But I've focused on the intellectual property pieces of it because From where I sit, intellectual property law is not, we can't reconcile it with libertarian principles. And so what intellectual property attempts to do is, or what it does, is grant limited monopoly rights to certain content creators, meaning inventors or authors. And the reason why I think that this is, you know, irreconcilable with libertarianism is because really what those laws do is tell you and I how we're allowed to use our own private property. And so what it purports to do is give the ownership over an idea, which is impossible, actually. So what it really does is give partial ownership to someone else over, say, your pen and paper or materials that you have in your garage, let's say.
All right, now, but so is this different, a different kind of regime of intellectual property than what we've had all along around here? In other words,
well,
is this something that the average American wouldn't find any reason to object to, only hardcore anarchists like you and me?
No, so it's different for a couple of reasons. The U.S. has very exacting and strict intellectual property rules domestically. And what this agreement does is extend some of those rules to other countries where there might have been more freedom in this space. So, for example, one of the big concerns and one of the things that's been most controversial has been the way that the TPP deals with pharmaceutical patents. So, for instance, in a lot of these, I think it's 11 countries plus the U.S. So in a lot of these 11 countries, it was relatively easy to make, for example, a generic drug that they could ship around the world and that consumers of drug products could have, you know, cheap and easy access to. And now with the TPP, the U.S. has sort of used its muscle as a trading partner and its bargaining power in that way to extend some of the very worst imaginable terms around pharma patents.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, they're going to be taking the poorest people in the world who right now are barely able to afford the medicines they need, and they're going to take their medicines away.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, to their credit, some of the countries that negotiated the TPP with the U.S. resisted some of the attempts by the U.S. and the U.S. pharma industry to extend these terms. And but they just, you know, they don't have the muscle sort of to stand up to the U.S. as a trading partner because, you know, the United States as a percentage of world GDP is so important that they sort of need to get in line. And that's what's happening here.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, who needs a one-world government under the U.N. when you have Washington, D.C. to rule them all?
Yeah, no, it's very true. I mean, and they've been sort of negotiating this largely in secret, and not, you know, not to sound too spooky or conspiratorial about it, but these negotiations were held in secret over the past, I guess, it's probably been a decade now, and industry groups like, again, the pharma industry certainly had access to the negotiating table, and I don't know about you, but I certainly didn't.
Yeah, no, of course not. None of us ever do. And then that's also why they always do the fast track, so Congress can't try to change anything. They can only vote it up or down, and so at the end of the day, they always vote it up.
Right. I mean, and that's what's sort of remarkable about this, too, is even elected officials, and, you know, I'm no fan of sort of the electoral system and the democratic system that we've got going on in the U.S., but even elected officials really had very little access to the language and to the negotiation process until late in the game. So it really was kind of just industry groups across international lines making sure that the U.S., the American draconian system of intellectual property is spread, you know, all across these Pacific Rim countries.
Mm-hmm. And now, so from the libertarian point of view, all intellectual property is just protectionism?
Well, you know, there's a big split in libertarianism about this question, and I've written a whole bunch about sort of the debate and the terms of the debate. Many libertarians are actually strong proponents of intellectual property protections, and that comes from sort of people like Ayn Rand who come from a good place of wanting to value the creator and protect the creator. And that's completely understandable and it makes sense on its face. But the problem is, as I said, what intellectual property rights purport to do is not really what they do. They purport to protect inventors and you know, authors. What they really do is give those people, you know, limited rights over what you're allowed to do with things that you own.
Right, which is just really a more accurate way of looking at it, the way that nobody ever describes it. But once you do, then, oh, you kind of see the hole in the other's argument pretty big right there.
It's pretty big, yeah, exactly. Because, right, like, that's to me, that's the way we ought to look at it, because, of course, we all, if you say, I'd like to protect inventors and I want a society that puts a high value on new innovation and spurs that on, then it's impossible to disagree with. But if you sort of show how intellectual property rights like patents and copyrights actually function, then people start to say, oh, well, yeah, I sort of didn't really think about it that way.
Right. Well, and you know, that's the thing about it when you get to, as you were saying, the level of these international agreements where no little guys anywhere, including even some of the national governments involved, really have much of a say in it. The industry groups are more powerful than the national governments doing the negotiation in many cases, and then, of course, completely own and control America's position in the thing. And so what we're talking about in practice is gangsterizing the hell out of a lot of the third world poor.
That's exactly what it is, and you're completely right that, the industry groups involved. I mean, if you compare U.S. pharma, big pharma here in the U.S. to a country like Brunei, I mean, of course, U.S. pharma's it's a country in its own right. I mean, and of course it has more bargaining power than one of those smaller nations that's going to be a party to this. They're just going to get run, basically, the U.S. and its interests are going to run roughshod over those little countries, and they're going to fall in line eventually one way or another.
Yeah. All right, y'all, that is David S. D'Amato. He is an attorney in international law and business. He writes for the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. And then this one is at Bleeding Heart Libertarians. Should libertarians support the TPP? Thanks very much, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was a great pleasure.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, all. How's it going? Good. I'm very happy to hear that. I'm pretending. Anyway. It's Friday. That means it's time for The Goal is Freedom, the weekly column of our good friend Sheldon Richman at Free Association. That's the name of his great blog. And, by the way, I should say this all the time when I interview Sheldon Richman. You donate $100 to this show, and one of your choices is you get a Sheldon Richman book, Your Money or Your Life Against the Income Tax, as your kickback. Hey, there's terrible background noise there, Sheldon. What's going on?
I'm walking to a quieter place.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good idea.
This is a hustle. There's a lot of hustle and bustle going on around here.
Right on. Okay. Hey, how are you doing? Early this morning, out there on the West Coast where I used to live for a little while.
Yeah, 10 o'clock to me is not early. I've been up at least 5 hours. So I'm doing fine. Yeah,
there you go. All right. Great to be with you. Good. Very happy to have you here. Hey, man. So, let's talk about this new article that you wrote. It's about Trump. And see, I got to admit, man, you know, when I see the headline, Trump compares Carson to a child molester because, you know, whatever, he supposedly did a violent thing one time in his life or whatever crap. I just laugh my ass off. I look at the destruction of Jeb Bush, which, boy, I mean, he was just going to destroy himself anyway. But Trump sure has helped. And I just love, it's a riot. I mean, I hate the guy. I know he's a fascist. I know if he was the president, it would be an absolute catastrophe. But I do appreciate him bringing all the rest of the scum in the Republican Party presidential campaign down to his level. But then I'm checking myself and I'm realizing that, you know what? We could laugh our way right into a fascist dictatorship with this guy here. I better do my part to get Sheldon on to make it just how clear, as clear as it could possibly be, just how bad of a president this guy could be if we were, as Americans, were to let him ever get that far. This article is called Trump's Operation Police State, and it really is that bad, huh?
Yeah, you know, I almost hesitate to criticize Trump as much as I love to, and there's so, because there's so much to criticize. But the reason I hesitate is that I don't want to imply that the others are really any better. I mean, I think my best line on Trump, which I find confirmed almost every day, is that the reason Trump outrages the establishment is that he's a caricature of it. So he's not really different in kind versus the others. He just exaggerates its most, you know, its faults,
right,
which is what a caricature does. A caricature does, of course, it exaggerates distinguishing characteristics, and therefore can be funny.
And then they just keep making it worse too, because they say he's not fit to be president, but then, man, he's really not that much different than the rest of them. So they're kind of admitting that none of them are fit to be the leader of any of us.
Right. Right. So with that caveat in mind, let's go ahead and talk about Trump. I do not mean to imply that I think Jeb Bush would be a good president or any of the others on either side of the aisle. So let's talk about Trump. And Trump, you know, one of the things that struck me about Trump early on, and I wrote about this, is the Mussolini style of him. Not so much even the exact content, but the very personal cult, almost cult of personality about him. It's like, I am going to make America great. I am better than anybody else. I will make deals. The others can't do that. You know, me. He thinks the only problem with government is, you know, the wrong person has been at the head of it and he's the right person. So it's this very personalized thing where he's not really, he doesn't really care much about the details. He doesn't care much about policy. It's just really trust me. You know, I'm the right guy. So just trust me no matter what I say. Unfortunately, there's that, his base. Believes that. I guess the good side is he's not really expanding that base. So
yeah.
He doesn't seem to be losing it either very much, but it's not growing. So there aren't increasing numbers of people who think, yes, let's just put our total trust in him and he'll take care, good care of us. So there is something Mussolini and sort of fascistic about it. Now the content is also, fascistic. I mean, on trade, I know we don't need to talk about trade, you want to talk more about immigration, but on trade, you know, he's going to make these deals, and he has this zero sum approach, right? We're going to win and they're going to lose because up till now we've been losing and they've been winning because we have stupid people making deals. Well, as a free trader, I don't want anybody making deals except the individual traders who are buying and selling things. They should be making deals for themselves, but I don't want anybody making a deal on behalf of the country. He doesn't seem to see that. Anyway, on immigration, of course, the operation, the reason I called it Operation Police State is, first of all, I was echoing his lauding of Eisenhower's Operation Wetback, but putting, I think, a better name on the particular, plan that, or proposal. It's not a plan yet, but proposal that Trump has, which is to round up, you know, more than 11 million people. There's no way you can do that without really having an outright police state.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, okay, I want to get back to the whole immigration question and the police state is promising and everything on the other side of the break, because we don't have time to really dive into that here. But it is a good place to backtrack on the trade question there, just back to it a little bit there. I was actually just talking with David S. D'Amato about the TPP, and it seemed to me like what he was arguing was the Americans, you know, generally speaking, the U.S. government and their captive special interests, that they're the ones who are winning, all right, just like in the new TPP is a perfect example of it, of shoving American policy, particularly on intellectual property and what have you, down the rest of the world's throat. But then again, China's not a part of that, and I don't know enough about these deals. I've never read a trade deal between China and the United States. Is it the case? It seems plausible enough that Bill Clinton and George W. Bush would have negotiated deals that aren't free trade at all, but actually do give some kind of advantage to the Chinese that would work against the United States. Everything they do works against the United States, right? So set me straight.
Well, I don't like to talk in terms of for or against the United States, because that's a huge collection of interests which aren't entirely in harmony. So, you know, you have different people and different groups that have different interests. So all of them being within the United States. I first of all, I'm distrustful of trade agreements. I think we should just have free trade. These are always, the, you know, thousands of pages long with lots of technical discussion about exceptions and this and that. So I don't see how that constitutes free trade. I really like the analysis of Kevin Carson. And Kevin Carson at the Center for Stateless Society has pointed out over and over again that what these so-called free trade agreements have done, they've been mainly a way to impose, and you already said this, to impose very draconian intellectual property regimes on foreign countries, which then keeps people there from making stuff that American companies want to have made there but sell under their own logos at highly inflated prices. So, you know, Nike wants factories to make Nikes, but they would not want those factory workers to break away, set up their own factory, and make stuff that look like Nikes. So therefore, Nike and the U.S. government, which is doing its bidding, imposes a very strict intellectual property, copyright, trademark, and patent laws on those countries. That's bad for them. That's also bad for American consumers who have to pay inflated prices because of IP. So in other words, the big companies, the big multinational companies, they don't care about tariffs and quotas much anymore. They're not trying to sell manufactured goods in the developing world, that stuff that's made in the U.S. in the developing world. So they don't care about that anymore. What they care about is IP, and I think that's largely right.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think Trump even has in mind, or it's just a slogan anyway?
Trump just sounds like an old style protectionist know-nothing, right? We're going to take our jobs back as if we own jobs. We're going to take our jobs. We're going to get our jobs back. So he's an old-fashioned protectionist. He doesn't understand the arguments for free trade. He looks like he's not even the least bit familiar with them. He just thinks we should protect American companies, but that is a route to impoverishment because the division of labor makes everybody richer when it's allowed to work. And as Adam Smith said, that the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. So we want the market to be as extended as possible without, government the one doing it. I don't want force being used to open markets, but I think there's a tendency to head toward a global market when people are free because they see the benefits of trade.
All right, hold it right there. We're already into the break, but we'll be right back and get to the immigration question. It's the great Sheldon Richman, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
I don't know, who's more wrong? The stupid kids saying we demand free college? Or the stupid Marine going, here's me marching for my free college, and it's him as a Marine training to kill people, to be a mercenary for a lousy American college education? You'd kill a stranger? Wow, what a burn. I think I'm on the side of the stupid commie kids on that one compared to the stupid fascist kids. What a mess. Anyway, I'm talking with Sheldon Richman, and he wrote this article about the insane lunatic Donald Trump. And the insane lunatic American right that loves him, that can't get enough of him. And they don't care if he's for partial birth abortions, and they don't care if he's for gun control, and they don't care if he's for progressive taxation, and they don't care if he's a liberal, left-wing, progressive, whatever they would claim to hate if it was anybody else. And the reason why is because he hates Mexicans. And they believe him when he says, he promises, he's gonna get rid of them for you. And so,
You know, maybe it's not politically correct to hate blacks nowadays, but you can sure as hell get away with hating Mexicans, and especially if you're a conservative, that's their last refuge, I guess. To save the old America from the way it's becoming now, Sheldon, and they just love it, man. And the more he says he's going to create a totalitarian police state to round up and deport 12 million people, the more they love it. But then again, he doesn't ever say anything about a totalitarian police state. He always just says, oh, you know, it'll be, I think he even said, it'll be gentle. It'll be fine. We'll just get them and tell them to go. So what do you say?
Yes, he says it'll be humane. And then he used as a model the 1954 Operation Wetback put in by Dwight Eisenhower. And he said, remember, I like Ike. People liked Ike. I like Ike. Well, that was a campaign slogan. I wouldn't attach a lot of weight to that. When people have looked, gone back and looked at Operation Wetback, and you can find articles in the Washington Post over the last couple of days and other places about this, it turns out it wasn't actually humane. They picked up people and drop them in the desert near Mexicali, Mexico at 125 degrees Fahrenheit without any provisions. And in one incident, 88 died of heat exhaustion. They put them on ships, which have been described by one historian as like a slave ship it was like hell on these ships. This was not humane. Now, he insists it will be humane, will be nice, we'll give them notice. He says all this sort of stuff. But look, people aren't walking around with patches on their clothing that says undocumented. And I hesitate to say that because he may think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
And that does remind us of an unfortunate episode in history, European history, to be more specific. They're not, you know, these are people who have lived, most of these are people who have lived in the United States for years, many years. They're part of communities. They go about their business, and they're not going to be just turn themselves over to his deportation force, as he calls it. I think he should have called it rapid deportation force, because I think, RPF would, or RDF would be, that's a snappy. It's a snappy abbreviation. He didn't use the word rapid, but it is going to be rapid. He says it'll be in 2 years, and has been pointed out by people, and I quote this in my article, if you try to deport 11 million people in 2 years, the bureaucracy, which we, as we know, is inept, and I don't care what Trump says, he's not going to make a government bureaucracy efficient, it's going to swallow up a whole bunch of people who they don't even intend to swallow up, namely a lot of American citizens too, possibly thousands or more of American citizens who will be detained and maybe even deported just because of bureaucratic snafus. So this is a nightmare. This will be a nightmare. What are we going to have? SWAT teams doing Afghan-style raids at night? Delta Force, maybe? Will he say the hell with Posse Comitatus too and bring in the military to break down doors in the middle of the night and capture people and their kids or break up families and send people back to Mexico. It's a nightmare vision. Imagine this being on the news all over the world, what's happening in the United States. It would be horrendous.
Yeah, but you know what? Once the temporary emergency is over, then the Department of Homeland Security will go back to the small, trim, lean, efficient organization that it is now, and will leave the rest of us alone, right?
I believe we've read that sort of thing.
I'm just a quarter Mexican and pretty damn light skin. You've seen me.
I think Robert Higgs would be teaching us that. The government shrinks back to its more benign size after the crisis. Oh, wait. I think I read that wrong. I think.
All right. So let me pretend to be stupid here for a second. But they're taking our jobs, man. And there are a lot of uneducated, working class Americans who just can't compete. I met a guy who said he had to leave the road crew because he didn't speak Spanish. And so many people on the road crew were immigrants, illegal and otherwise, that he ended up having to move to a lower skilled, lower wage job, doesn't have a great education, trying to take care of his family, and he's here first. And then the other argument is, hey, my whole damn side of town is all Mexicans now, it's a different culture, it's a different, maybe it's not a gun to my head in direct force, but it seems like you're forcing an entirely different way of life on me when you surround me by whatever number of thousands or millions of new people from somewhere else.
Well, on the matter of jobs, I mean, look, you can find anecdotes, But even as Brian Kaplan, who's an advocate of open borders, points out, the most prominent labor economist who is critical of immigration says that the, you know, the worst damage is a long run decline of about under 5% in wages for high school dropouts. Other groups actually will benefit. This is coming from the most prominent labor economist in the anti-immigrant camp. So it's there aren't generally horrendous you know, things to fear about immigrants coming in. Does that mean no one will be displaced? Of course not. But as Ben Powell of the Independent Institute likes to point out, and he's just done a book on this. When new people come in, first of all, they're coming to produce. The second thing is they're moving from capital poor areas to capital rich areas, which means they'll be much more productive here than they would be in a developing economy. Now, you know, Mexico is further along in development than other countries, but the point is it doesn't have as much capital as the U.S. does. So when you take a worker and move them from a capital poor area to a capital rich area, that means more tools, more machinery, which augments human labor. That's what machines and capital goods do. So in other words, those people will be more productive than they would have been, but that means they're producing more things for sale, more stuff for us. Does that mean no one will have to change jobs? Of course not, but that's true anyway. Technology displaces people all the time, more so than trade does and more so than people coming in from other countries. So that's just part of life, unfortunately. You may not like change, but that's the way it is. Good or bad, that's the way it is. As far as culture, I don't see how a person has a right or a group has a right to, quote, protect its culture if that means violating the freedom of other people. That's besides, culture has never been a static thing anyway. The culture that we enjoy today, however you may define it, is not something that existed 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years ago. It was, you know, changing all the time because of people coming in. So,
all right, but now the right wing argument is they want to bring in these people and change our culture to one where everybody votes Democrat because they're all immigrants who've been promised that they can get on the dole one way or the other. And so it's social engineering the whole damn society to the left in that sense.
Yeah, but see, but this is this contradiction again. What do we fear now? We fear that they're taking our jobs or they're coming on welfare. I mean, they're not really doing both things. First of all, you can't go on welfare, I think, for 5 years after you become a legal immigrant. So, you know, that's no one's coming here to go on welfare. Now, as far as rules like every hospital has to take any comer, regardless of ability to pay. You know, those are laws that we need to critique and change, but not violate other people's freedom because of. This is what I don't understand. Sure, the government, lots of bad laws have been passed that compel people to do things against their will when they may not want to. You can't use those as an argument to violate people's freedom. Including and rights don't just belong to Americans. Even the Constitution, if you want to go no further than the Constitution, and I certainly do not want to stop there. If you go no further than the Constitution talks about persons, not citizens.
Right.
So rights belong to people as human beings. Not
it also
Americans.
Doesn't say anything about the national government taking charge of who's allowed inside the borders or not. And I mean, as far as obviously they have the right to keep foreign armies out, you know, foreign governments out, but that's it.
Well, that's less clear. If you read the clause that, you know, expired in 1809, that seems to suggest that the national government does have say over that. But, I'm not basing this on the Constitution. I don't know, understand why. The Constitution allows lots of things that violate freedom, like eminent domain. So, I'm a natural rights guy. If the Constitution coincides, where the Constitution coincides with natural rights, great. But there are a lot of places where it doesn't.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. All right, well, listen. And one more point to make is we already have a police state on the border, a ruthless totalitarian one that kills people by the scores every single year, that jails people by the tens and tens of thousands. Obama has the world record for 2 million deportations, far more than George W. Bush. And of course, there's the whole, you know, constitution free zone where they can stop and search anybody on the lower threshold within 100 miles of the international borders of the seas, which is 2/3 of the population of the country, of course, live on the coasts or, you know, in the north or the south. Yeah. So anyway,
that's why I said beefed up the police state, not creative.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just imagine what it would really be like. I mean, seriously, imagine it at night in your scene too. You know, this Homeland Security state. In fact, they'd probably have to hire a bunch of illegals to staff and to, so they'd have enough cops to carry out the purge of the rest of them. But anyway.
Yeah, one more thing. He's totally wrong, Trump, on birthright citizenship. He says legal scholars say that he's right and that a child born in the United States, even if his parents aren't citizens, should not be treated as a citizen. He's threatening to deport even those kids. That's totally wrong. Damon Root has an article at Reason.com which blasts that to smithereens.
Great.
That's established in law that if you're born here, you're a citizen, unless you're the child of a diplomat or, you know, invading army.
Exactly. Soldier. Yeah, well, in fact, there's one the other day where even veterans who signed up and went and fought and killed people in the Iraq War on the promise they'd get citizenship out of it are getting kicked right the hell out of the country instead. Thanks a lot, sucker. Man, it's unbelievable the ruthlessness of the U.S. government. They just don't give a damn about anybody at all. You know, they'll put those same people on the pedestal like they're our demigods and then throw them in the garbage. It's just incredible. Anyway, overtime. True. Hey, thanks, man. You're the best, Sheldon.
Anytime, Scott. Good talk to you.
All right, y'all. That is the great Sheldon Richmond. Sheldon, freeassociation.blogspot.com. Just SheldonRichmond.com. It'll forward you on there. And we're already back again. Ain't that convenient? That was Sheldon Richmond, the great Sheldon Richmond. Apologies to Jim Bovard for botching his interview earlier. I started off on that rant thinking I was going to come to a question, and then I never did come up with one. I just said, I hate the government a lot, don't you? Yeah. There's one here where the cop turned his body camera off, killed a 19-year-old girl, turned it back on again. No charges, has just been brought back from his paid vacation to full duty. I mean, really? And that isn't just a license to kill. That's a license to murder and obstruct justice and commit perjury and do whatever you want. Break any law in the world. And as long as you're a government employee and your object is having fun at the expense of the lives of other people. But, Your Honor, I was on the clock when I murdered the girl. And I forget if I said this on the radio. I think I said this in an interview or something. But I want to make a movement out of this. This should be a whole yes man satirical kind of a thing where we really work to create a political party, a separate political party for the cops. So we can get over this pretense that they represent our interests at all, that they are here for us at all. They're not. And the fact of their union's existence and the way that they operate, and every one of every police union in America's public statements ought to show that that is true. What they are is they're people who want to be your overlords, but aren't educated or connected enough to be politicians. So they're thug cops instead. They're the politician's enforcement arm. And they're criminals, and they have the right to murder us, and they know it. They know that, hey, man, whatever. And you can tell that this is true, that you know that this is the training for all cops in America. If your partner or another cop on the scene starts shooting, everybody shoot. If you have to shoot somebody, have to. If you get a chance to shoot somebody, you better make sure you kill them. You shoot them over and over and over until you kill them and make sure they're dead. And if they're, you know, possible to bleed out, make sure and roll them over so they'll bleed out. Like Tamir Rice. Do everything you can. Hope and pray to Jesus that the person will die on the scene and won't be able to live to testify against you. to make a statement. I had my hands up. Nope, he was reaching for his waistband. Can't cross-examine him because he's dead. The cop says the unarmed man was reaching for his waistband. Why would he reach for his waistband? Was he pulling up his pants in preparation to get on the ground as he was being told? Like the guy who the cop got away with murdering just the other day. The cop finished getting away with murdering the guy out in front of the 7-Eleven. Remember that one? The kid with the headphones on? The cop's screaming at him, and the kid finally notices, huh, what? The cop's going, get on the ground! So he goes to grab his belt to pull up his pants so he can get down on his knees, and the cop just blam, 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 blam. To death. All day, every day. No accountability. Doesn't matter what your race is. They kill more white people than black people. Boy, it's true they kill black people out of proportion to white people. Blacks are only approximately 13% of the population of America, and they are killed at almost the same rate per day as white Americans by the cops. So, you know, it's not like they don't have reason to complain, but don't misunderstand the situation that only blacks are being executed by cops all day, every day, because that's not so. The cops murder whoever they feel like murdering. That's who they murder. Who they feel like. And they get away with it always.
Goddamn government.
And I just love seeing how much people love government. They just love it so much. Oh, government, I love you. Oh, government, you're my hero. Oh, government, you protect me. Oh, government, please social engineer the society to make it just the way I want it to be. Oh, government, I hate you for letting me down. Oh, government, I love you so much. It's really pathetic. I'll recommend you again to this great article by Scott H. Greenfield. Lawyer. You gotta read this thing. Seriously, man, read it. It's called Tamir Rice's Basically Reasonable Murder. And it's about how the reasonable clause of the Fourth Amendment is the only thing that forbids the government from ending your life. That's it. It says there they can't seize your person or your property in an unreasonable way. That is the only thing stopping them from just executing all of us and laughing their ass off all day long, I guess. It's got to be reasonable. That's it. And it's not like any of the rest of the murder laws that apply to the rest of us. Whole different standard. And then from there, Greenfield, like a brilliant professor here, absolutely explains, if he missed anything, I'd be shocked. He goes through case, decision, court opinion, by opinion, by opinion, by opinion, that says that the only view is what the cop now claims his view was then. Doesn't matter what you think you might do or a reasonable person might do in his position. You're not a trained law enforcement officer. The only point of view that counts is his. And the only, information you're allowed to use to determine that is what he says in his own defense. And on and on and on. I can't sum it up very well for you, but you gotta read it, man. You just gotta read it. This is how every cop in America ultimately has the same sovereign immunity that Lon Horiuchi has, or that, Austin cop that got away with it, where did it go, man? Oh, he doesn't have the guy's name in here. Good. Well, yeah, don't honor that son of a bitch, but the Austin cop that killed Larry Jackson. They all have that immunity in a de facto kind of a way. That's why the only time you ever hear a cop about a cop getting prosecuted is if he just outright screams the N-word 7 times as he kills the guy and it's on video, or some extreme circumstance like that where it gets prosecuted as a federal civil rights case where they think they can prove he did it because of his racism. That kind of thing. To deny someone else their rights because of their race. Very, very narrow category. And even that hardly ever happens. Never happens to the feds. The FBI agents have never been prosecuted for any person they've ever killed on the job. Ever. Ever. So, and that goes for, you know, almost, there's 10 or 15 national government departments that have their own armed agents. It's incredible, really. But yeah, man, you got to read this thing. In fact, I'm going to read it again. I keep pulling it up. I keep recommending it to people, and I want to read it again. I want to try to memorize this and really learn this stuff. Tamir Rice's Basically Reasonable Murder. How can a cop kill a 12-year-old boy with a toy gun without even saying drop it or anything? Kid wasn't even holding it. It was tucked in his pants. And get away with it. And leave him there to bleed out and die and tackle and beat the crap out of his sister when she came to try to save him and help him, when they just left him to die on the cold floor like the mythical Iraqi army of Kuwait 1990. How can that be reasonable? Read it at blog.simplejustice.us. Tamir Rice's Basically Reasonable Murder. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at mastersamuraitech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from mastersamuraitech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at mastersamuraitech.com. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm real sorry about the website, man. Whenever it breaks, it stays broken for a while. But it should be fixed today or tomorrow or something. My guy said he's got a guy on it now. So it'd be better if my guy was on it, but he said that would take longer. So I don't know. It's going to be my guy's guy. We're going to see what happens with the thing. Anyway, it's funny because I talked to a buddy of mine last night, and I was like, wait, so what was the last interview you heard? And I went back through the list, and the last one he heard was Coburn. Andrew, it was the day I did Andrew and Patrick Coburn interviews on the same day. And there's been a lot since then. So I guess I'm over 4,000 now. I went through and deleted all those old drafts. Oh, and in fact, you know what? I may be way over 4,000 because when I went and looked at antiwar.com/radio, I took a couple of sample examples. I found where there are way more interviews on antiwar.com than there are on my site. There are so many missing. I have no idea. So hopefully once the site gets up, then we're going to get the two websites reconciled. We're going to get all the ones on antiwar.com/radio over to scotthorton.org/interviews. Make sure the archive is completely full for you. It'll be over 4,000 at that point. Anyway. Hey, if you're on Twitter at all, go there now because Why I Am Anti-War is trending. Angela Keaton has got that trending right now on Twitter. Isn't that great? She sent it to a bunch of individual libertarians, members of the movement, asked them, why are you anti-war, to get it going. A lot of people are tweeting and retweeting and joining in, and there's a lot of good stuff on there. And I was happy to see that somebody said, because I went and listened to Scott Horton's interview archive, and there were too many reasonable opinions there, I had to give up, basically. and admit I was wrong, something along those lines. So that's pretty cool, man. It's one down, 300 million to go. But yeah, check that out. All right, so I got to talk about this, man. This is what goes on in Palestine that you don't understand, or maybe you do, and in which case, I guess what I said doesn't apply to you. But if you don't understand this, understand this. Israeli troops storm Palestinian hospital, killing suspect. Took a wounded Palestinian with them. Israeli troops dressed like civilians, wheeling another soldier disguised as a pregnant woman, forced their way into a Palestinian hospital in Hebron this morning, killing a Palestinian man they described as a, quote, suspect, before loading the man's cousin, a patient who they say they were there to question, into the wheelchair and hauling him off to an unknown location. Hospital director Jihad Shaur slammed the raid, saying that relatives of the slain man and his disappeared cousin are very angry. They added there was no evidence the man the troops killed, who they claim attacked them, was armed in the first place. Israeli military officials described every member of the family in question as known Hamas operatives. And Shin Bet said that the attack on the hospital was fine because they won't allow terror operatives to feel safe anywhere. Terror operatives. Yeah, that's what they do. So there's Amnesty International is demanding an investigation into this apparent, as they call it, extrajudicial execution. And this is what they're doing, man. And if you listen to any right-wing media at all, they would have you believe that Palestine is the country next door that is endlessly aggressing against the poor, helpless Israelis. But who's occupying who? The Palestinians already lost over and over again. And East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip have been occupied unendingly since 1967. So, yeah. It's hard for somebody to be an insurgent if there's not some alien force they're rising up against, huh? And argue with any Zionist, and they'll say, yeah, but don't the Israeli Jews have a right to their own country and da-da-da-da-da, and let me change the subject away from the occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip to poor little Israel and their right to exist. Land for peace. What a great slogan. Land for peace. As though the terrorists are holding poor little Israel hostage. And unless Israel will give up some of their land to the terrorists won't leave them alone. But who would believe that terrorists blackmailing them would ever leave them alone? Once they attempt to bribe them, they'll only be appeased and demand even more. Again, as though we're talking about a foreign country next door that is expanding at Israel's expense instead of the truth, which is the other way around. They're lying to you. That's why the things you believe are wrong. Just go look at a map. And I love this one. Well, there are lots of Arab countries. Why don't all the Palestinians just go live there? Ah, okay. Again, now we get it. Your right to exist must be at the expense of the existence of other people. If they don't like it, let them go and die in the Saudi desert, right? All your water are belong to us. And really all it is white supremacy. It's more white supremacy than it is Jewish supremacy, really. I mean, there are the Sephardic Jews who obviously are part of the system in a way, but that's ultimately what it's about. The fairer skinned get away with it and are backed by the Western powers for that same reason. Kind of crazy. Sure is true, though. And yeah, if it was any other country, If I came in here and said, look, everybody, Assad sent his soldiers and dressed up as a pregnant woman to assassinate a man in his hospital bed, you would say, yeah, Hillary and Jeb are right. We need a safe zone. We should protect those Syrians because who will ever help the poor Syrians? But no, it was the Israelis what did that. Oh, I guess the guy must have had it coming or something, right? Or else why would they do that? I mean, they said that he had it coming. So, pretty sure he must have had it coming, right? Yeah. Anyway. I don't know. I was going to say something about Syria, but I don't know what to say about Syria other than the peace talks are nothing and are going nowhere. There are way too many players involved in the actual war and in the talks. They invited in a bunch of parties to the talks who have nothing to do with them at all. The whole thing is set up to fail, as Gareth Porter wrote and explained on the show just the other day. And every interest is so split and so contradictory here. It's just going to go on and on. Well, really not. The Russia Shiite side makes sense, at least. Their policy is pretty clear. But there are so many contradictions on the NATO side of this thing. Like, for example, America backing the YPG Kurds against the Islamic State, while our NATO allies, the Turks, back the Islamic State against the Kurds and bomb the Kurds them damn selves. And while at the same time, America and Turkey work together to back the Islamic State's enemies, the al-Nusra Front, who are exactly like them, except in competition for power with them. And the al-Nusra Front and their alliance with the Army of Conquest and Arar al-Sham, which is really what it is, Nusra and al-Sham together, the mythical moderates, the ones who are being bombed right along with ISIS, who are exactly like them, by the Russians. As America fights still to limit the power and authority and perhaps even ultimately regime change, the Assad regime, as Barack Obama explained to Jeffrey Goldberg back in 2012, in order to bring Iran down a peg to weaken their influence, as the Russians have already called that bluff and said, no, you can't. We'll back up the Assad government with force and prove it to you and send in their air force. Saudis aren't backing down. Turks aren't backing down. Although the Turks seem to think that they can just kill all the Kurds themselves without ISIS's help either way. I don't know. See you Monday, guys.